Chapter 33. "Can you put us closer to the Dominance Peak?" Saracen asked his brother Charles Oxley, who was at the controls of a small amphibious flying boat. "The crest of the lower one is too sharp for our requirements." "Do you see something?" Saracen peered through binoculars out a side window of the aircraft. "The island has definite possibilities, but it would help if I knew what sort of landmark to look for." Oxley banked the twin turboprop-engined Baffin CZ-410 for a better view of Isla Danzante, a steep-sided 5-square-kilometer, 3-square-mile rock formation that jutted 400 meters, 1,312 feet, above the Sea of Cortez, just south of the popular resort town of Loreto. "Has the right look about it," he commented, staring down. "Two small beaches to land boats. The slopes are honeycombed with small caves. What do you say, brother?" Saracen turned and looked at the man in the rear passenger seat. "I say the esteemed Professor Moore is still holding out on us." "You'll be alerted to the proper site when I see it," Moore said curtly. "I say we throw the little bastard out the hatch and watch him try to fly," Saracen snapped harshly. Moore crossed his arms smugly. "You do, and you'll never find the treasure." "I'm getting damned sick of hearing that." "What about Isla Danzante?" asked Oxley. "Has it got the right features?" Moore snatched the binoculars from Saracen without asking and peered at the broken terrain running across the ridge of the island. After a few moments, he handed them back and relaxed in his seat with an iced shaker of martinis. "Not the one we are looking for," he proclaimed regally. Saracen clasped his hands tightly to prevent them from strangling Moore. After a few moments, he regained a degree of composure and turned the page of the same boater's guide that was being used by Pitt. "Next search point is Isla Carmen. Size 150 square kilometers. Length 30 kilometers. Has several peaks rising over 300 meters. "That's a pass," announced Moore. "Far too large." "Your speedy response is duly noted," Saracen muttered sarcastically. "After that, we have Isla Choya, a small flat-topped rock with a light tower and a few fishing huts." "Skip that one, too," said Moore. "Okay, next up is Isla San Ildefonso, 6 miles offshore east of San Sebastian." "Size?" "About 2.5 square kilometers, no beaches." "There has to be a beach," said Moore, taking another slug from his martini shaker. He swallowed the last few drops, and his face took on an expression of deprivation. The Incas could not have landed and unloaded their rafts without a beach. "After San Ildefonso, we come to Bahia Coyote," said Saracen. "There we'll have a choice of 6 islands that are little more than huge rocks rising from the sea." Oxley eased the Baffin amphibian into a slow climb until he reached 700 meters, about 2,300 feet. Then he set a course due north. 25 minutes later, the bay and the long peninsula that shield it from the gulf came into view. Oxley descended and began circling the small rocky islands scattered around the entrance to the bay. "Isla Guapa and Isla Bargo are possibilities," observed Saracen. "They both rise sharply from the water and have small but open summits." Moore squirmed sideways in his seat and peered down. "They don't look promising to me." He stopped talking and grabbed Saracen's binoculars again. "That island down there." "Which one?" queried Saracen irritably. "There are 6 of them." "The one that looks like a floating duck looking backward." "Isla Bargo." "Fits the profile. Steep walls on 3 sides, rounded crest. There is also a small beach in the crook of the neck." "That's it," Moore said excitedly. "That must be it." Oxley was skeptical. "How can you be so sure?" A curious look crossed Moore's face for a fleeting instant. A gut feeling, nothing more. Saracen snatched back the glasses and studied the island. There, on the crown. It looks like something carved in the rock. Don't pay any attention to that, said Moore, wiping a trickle of sweat from his forehead. It doesn't mean a thing. Saracen was no fool. Could it be a signpost cut by the Incas to mark the passageway to the treasure? He wondered in silence. Moore sank back in his seat and said nothing. I'll land and taxi to that little beach, said Oxley. From the air, at least, it looks like a relatively easy climb to the summit. Saracen nodded. Take her down. Oxley made two passes over the water off the island's beach, making certain there were no underwater reefs or rocks that could tear out the bottom of the aircraft. He came into the wind and settled the plane on the blue sea, striking the light swells and riding them like a speedboat across a choppy lake. The propellers flashed in the sun as they whipped sheets of spray over the wing. The plane quickly slowed from the drag of the water as Oxley eased back on the throttles, keeping just enough power to move the plane toward the beach. 46 meters, 151 feet from shore, he extended the wheels into the water. The tires soon touched and gripped the sandy shelf that sloped toward the island. 2 minutes later, the plane rose from a low surf and rolled onto the beach like a dripping duck. Two fishermen wandered over from a small driftwood shack and gawked at the aircraft as Oxley turned off the ignition switches and the propellers swung to a stop. The passenger door opened and Saracen stepped down to the white sand beach, followed by Moore and finally Oxley, who locked and secured the door and cargo hatch. As an added security measure, Saracen generously paid the fishermen to guard the plane. Then they set off on a scarcely defined footpath leading to the top of the island. At first the trail was an easy hike, but then it angled more steeply the closer they came to the summit. Gulls soared over them, squawking and staring down at the sweating humans through indifferent, beady eyes. Their flight was majestic as they steered by the feathers in their tails, wings outstretched and motionless to catch the warm updrafts. One particularly curious bird swooped over Moore and splattered his shoulder. The anthropologist, appearing to suffer from the effects of alcohol and exertion, stared dumbly at his stained shirt, too tired to curse. Saracen, a wide grin on his face, saluted the gull and climbed over a large rock blocking the trail. Then the blue sea came into view, and he looked across the channel to the white sand beach of Playa El Coyote and the Sierra El Cardenal mountains beyond. Moore had stopped, gasping for air, sweat flowing freely. He looked on the verge of collapse when Oxley grabbed his hand and heaved him onto the flat top of the summit. "Didn't anybody ever tell you booze and rock climbing don't mix?" Moore ignored him. Then, suddenly, the exhaustion washed away, and he stiffened. His eyes squinted in drunken concentration. He brushed Oxley aside and stumbled toward a rock the size of a small automobile that was crudely carved in the shape of some animal. Like a drunk who had witnessed a vision, he staggered around the rock sculpture, his hands fluttering over the rough, uneven surface. "A dog," he gasped between labored breaths. "It's only a stupid dog." "Wrong," said Saracen. "A coyote, the namesake of the bay. Superstitious fishermen carved it as a symbol to protect their crews and boats when they go to sea." "Why should an old rock carving interest you?" asked Oxley. "As an anthropologist, primitive sculptures can be a great source of knowledge." Saracen was watching Moore, and for once his eyes were no longer filled with distaste. There was no question in his mind that the drunken professor had given away the key to the treasure's location. He could kill more now, Saracen thought icily. Throw the little man over the edge of the island's west palisade into the surf that crashed on the rocks far below. And who would care? The body would probably drift out with the tide and become shark food. Any investigation by local Mexican authorities was doubtful. You realize, of course, that we no longer require your services, don't you, Henry? It was the first time Saracen had uttered Moore's given name, and there was an unpleasant familiarity about it. Moore shook his head and spoke with an icy composure that seemed unnatural under the circumstances. You'll never do it without me. A pathetic bluff, Saracen sneered. Now that we know we're searching for an island with a sculpture, an ancient one, I presume, what more can you possibly contribute to the search? Moore's drunkenness had seemingly melted away, and he abruptly appeared as sober as a judge. A rock sculpture is only the first of several benchmarks the Incas erected. They all have to be interpreted. Saracen smiled. It was a cold and evil smile. You wouldn't lie to me now, would you, Henry? You wouldn't deceive my brother and me into thinking Isla Bargo isn't the treasure site, so you can return later on your own and dig it up? I sincerely hope that little plot isn't running through your mind. Moore glared at him, simple dislike showing where there should have been fear. Blow off the top of the island, he said with a shrug, and see what it gets you. Level it to the waterline. You won't find an ounce of Huascar's treasure, not in 1,000 years. Not without someone who knows the secrets of the markers. He may be right, Oxley said quietly. And if he's lying, we can return and excavate on our own. Either way, we win. Saracen smiled bleakly. He could read Henry Moore's thoughts. The anthropologist was playing for time, waiting and scheming to use the ultimate end of the search to somehow claim the riches for himself. But Saracen was a schemer, too, and he had considered every option. At the moment he could see no avenue open for Moore to make a miraculous escape with tons of gold. Certainly not unless Moore had a plan that he had not yet fathomed. Leniency and patience. They were the watchwords for now, Saracen decided. He patted Moore on the back. Forgive my frustration. Let's get back to the plane and call it a day. I think we could all use a cool bath, a tall margarita, and a good supper. Amen, said Oxley. We'll take up tomorrow where we left off today. I knew you'd see the light, said Moore. I'll show you the way. All you boys have to do is keep the faith. When they arrived back at the aircraft, Saracen entered first. On a hunch, he picked up Moore's discarded martini shaker and shook a few drops onto his tongue. Water, not gin. Saracen silently cursed himself. He had not picked up on how dangerous Moore was. Why would Moore act the role of a drunk if not to lull everyone into thinking he was harmless? He slowly began to comprehend that Henry Moore was not entirely what he seemed. There was more to the famous and respected anthropologist than met the eye. Much more. As a man who could kill without the slightest remorse, Saracen should have recognized another killer when he saw one. Mickey Moore stepped out of the blue-tiled swimming pool below the hacienda and stretched out on a lounge chair. She was wearing a red bikini that did very little to conceal her thin form. The sun was warm, and she did not dry herself, preferring to let the water drops cling to her body. She glanced up at the main house and motioned to one of the servants to bring her another Rum Collins. She acted as though she were the mistress of the manor, totally disregarding the armed guards who roamed the grounds. Her behavior was hardly in keeping with someone who was being held hostage. The hacienda was built around the pool, and a large garden filled with a variety of tropical plants. All major rooms had balconies with dramatic views of the sea and the town of Guaymas. She was more than happy to relax around the pool or in her skylit bedroom with its own patio and jacuzzi, while the men flew up and down the gulf in search of the treasure. She picked up her watch from a small table. 5 o'clock. The conniving brothers and her husband would be returning soon. She sighed with pleasure at the thought of another fabulous dinner of local dishes. After the servant girl brought the rum Collins, Mickey drank it down to the ice cubes and settled back for a brief nap. Just before she drifted off, she thought she heard a car drive up the road from town and stop at the front gate of the hacienda. When she awoke a short time later, her skin felt cool and she sensed that the sun had passed behind a cloud. But then she opened her eyes and was startled to see a man standing over her, his shadow thrown across the upper half of her body. The eyes that stared at her looked like stagnant black pools. There was no life to them. Even his face seemed incapable of expression. The stranger appeared emaciated, as if he had been sick for a long time. Mickey shivered as though an icy breeze suddenly swept over her. She thought it odd that he took no notice of her exposed body, but gazed directly into her eyes. She felt as if he were looking inside her. "Who are you?" she asked. "Do you work for Mr. Zolar?" He did not reply for several seconds. When he spoke, it was with an odd voice with no inflection. "My name is Tupac Amaru." And then he turned and walked away.